everybody. I am Jim Loy, a visiting fellow here at the Freeman Chair, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of Charles Freeman, who is traveling today so wasn't able to make it, and also our co-sponsors, the U.S. Chamber, Jeremy Waterman here to my left. I think we're in for a very interesting and fascinating presentation today. It's cliche to say that virtually every global issue that's out there has some China component, but I think what's different and unique about the research that we're going to hear more about today is that it illustrates the nexus between all those issues, whether it's environment, global warming, energy, food security, the nexus between China's impact on those issues and the decisions that China makes as it deals with the enormous internal migration that's going to occur from the countryside to the cities, and how China plans for that will impact greatly. It's you know, not only the amount that it pollutes, but a host of other issues. And having recently returned from living for 3 years in Beijing, I have a very personal impact in terms of seeing the challenges that the government faces. And I'll be interested in hearing, what the government's take is of this research and if it's having any policy traction. So I'm not going to read the bios. We've got some time pressures today. Folks have to move on from here. The bios are on the sheet that's on your chair. But very quickly, we have Deanna Farrell, who's the director of the McKinsey Global Institute. Three seats to my left here. Jenna Mitra Devon, a senior fellow with McKinsey Global Institute based out of Shanghai, and Thomas Campanella, who's a professor of urban planning at UNC Chapel Hill, but right now at least is on loan to Harvard University. And immediately to my left is Jeremy Waterman, who's senior director for Greater China at the U.S. Chamber. And I'm going to ask him to make a few welcoming remarks before we start on the presentation.
Thanks, Jim. And I'd like to acknowledge CSIS for their partnership in this effort. Charles, who's not here, and Jim are really doing terrific work here. And it's exciting for us to be able to work with them on such an important issue. I'd also like to acknowledge the three speakers who are with us today, in particular Deanna Farrell, who's director of the McKinsey Global Institute, and really just compliment the work that you're doing on so many cutting-edge issues that are shaping globalization and key trends that are affecting business and policymaking around the world, whether it's sovereign wealth funds, energy, healthcare. Really have your pulse on so many of the key issues. And we're doing our best to follow your lead in that regard. I'm just back from an energy forum last week that the U.S. Chamber co-hosted with the Energy Research Institute of the National Development Reform Commission. And we had a chance to talk over 2 days about a lot of the energy and environmental issues that are highlighted, I think, and challenges in the report prepared by McKinsey. And certainly where there are challenges, there are also opportunities, business opportunities, and opportunities to bring the two governments close and peoples closer together. And we'll certainly be using the work, Deanna and John Amitra, that you have done at the Institute to shape our engagement and cooperation with the Chinese government going forward. So with that, let me certainly looking forward to your presentations today. But let me turn it over to you.
I get to do one more brief introduction, but this one will be more about McKinsey Global Institute. First of all, thank you both CSIS and Chamber of Commerce for bringing this board. We've been lucky to be guests of each of you, but never together. So this is a two-for-one. Thank you. And I'm very delighted to introduce my colleague, John Mitra Devon, who is actually heads up our MGI presence in Shanghai, where we have over the last several years done a host of work. And I thought what would be helpful, you alluded to this a little bit, Jeremy, to set the stage, is to explain to you a little bit about MGI, who we are, and how the China agenda fits into our broader research agenda. And then John Amitra will give you the latest episode of our research there, which is really an exciting perspective on patterns of urbanization in China and some of the key challenges for China and for the world from these developments. So the best way to think about McKinsey Global Institute is really as McKinsey and Company's internal economics research arm. And we bring, in the world of so many think tanks like CSIS and so many others, a slightly different perspective to these pictures, which is what we like to characterize as a microeconomic effect, a microeconomic look at macroeconomic issues. And we start with what we know best, which is what companies do, industry structure, and use that window to inform some of these big, broad issues around energy, as Jeremy mentioned, more recently around the pattern of development in China, which is no longer just a China story. It is a global story. And over the last several years, we've done work on China's financial system. We've done work on China's consumer developments, but very quickly, all of this boils down to what you believe is going to be the pattern of Chinese urbanization. And so I'm absolutely delighted to introduce Janmeet Devan, senior fellow at Shanghai, who will talk to us about this work.
Thank you. Yeah. So three topics that I'm going to try to cover very quickly. One is to give you the top line messages in terms of what the numbers indicate in urbanization. Number two, I'll go through some of the scenarios, touch on the pressure points of urbanization. And then finally, we'll talk about a concept that we've introduced, and not only a concept, but a series of policy measures that we think China could adopt that we've begun to actually have some very good discussions with government leaders. What are the top line factoids, right, that are coming out of urbanization? Well, one is that China is going to redefine urbanization scale. We're talking about a future China that is going to have roughly 350 million new urban citizens, right, living in cities, which is the population of the entire United States and then some. To put this in perspective, it will be about 200 cities with greater than a million in population. Compare this to Europe's 35 today, and you know the story is of China is a big one. 50,000 new skyscrapers, equivalent of about 10 Manhattans. Right? What is the net impact? You know that would cause in China. Over 170 mass transit systems. All of Europe, including Russia today, has about 70. So, and you're talking about these as net additions, right? Net additional requirements in China over the next 20 years, right? And all of this, our fact base says that, you know, by 2025, we're going to see Chinese urbanization, China have about a billion people. Slightly less than that. Let me very quickly give you an indication of what the past patterns of urbanization was. Right? So from 1990 to 2005, we saw more than a doubling of the urban population from 254 to 572 million. And the interesting thing down here, and I wanted to spend a few minutes, right, that when we built up this bottom-up approach of what was going on, and I think this is one of the first few studies that had really taken a bottom-up approach to figuring out what was going on in urbanization, which means that city by city, what the numbers were, and getting a good feel for what was taking place. As we did this, we unfolded some surprises. One is, and we thought that we could do this in 2 months. It turned out to be a year's effort, right, just to clean the data in China, there were as many definitions, right, of what an urban area was as there were cities, right, in China. There's a city in the in south central part of China, which was in fact affected by the recent earthquake, Chongqing, right. And if you spoke to any city official in Chongqing, you would get very quickly that, you know, they believe that they were the largest city in the world with 34 million people. But when you looked at the map of Chongqing, you'd find that it was about the size of the state of Maryland, right? So there's just no way that that could be a city. So looking at these as we unfolded the onions, we knew that there was inconsistencies in the numbers. So we had to straighten that out, right, and impose a definition throughout China and then rebuild the numbers bottom up. And number two, a number of you may also know, China follows an internal passport system called the Hukou system, right, which basically gives these are residency permits, if you want, right? If you are from Shanghai, you have the Shanghai Hukou. If you're from Chongqing, you have the Chongqing Hukou. Now, what this meant was that when you looked at actual population numbers, you had highly distorted numbers, right? The people who were registered in the books need not necessarily be living in those cities. So that's another thing that we had to take care of. Prior to 1990, that was not an issue because there was very little migration, but post-1990, there was a tremendous amount of migration that took place, which distorted the numbers. And then lo and behold, right, when we also looked at the number of cities, we found that a strange occurrence. In 1990, China had officially about 440 cities or so. I can't remember the exact number. In 1996, that went up to about 663. And then in 2005, it still remained at 663, which was impossible because between 1995 and 2005, you had a spurt of growth, right? So there should be more cities. And what, again, when we investigated the those particular numbers, what had turned out was that in 1996, the Chinese government decided to stop or at least slow down, right, the designation of new cities. And they had pretty, you know, well-defined criteria on how you define the city and so on. So what was happening was that in 1996, every county, right, or every county mayor or every town wanted to become a city, right, because there were advantages in becoming a city, right? And there was a lot of fraud, right, that went with it, enhancing GDP numbers to fictitious levels so that they could qualify to become city. So the Chinese government, I think, rightly, you know, took the view that, look, we've got to slow this down. But then what turned out was that by 2005, the number still remained at 663, so they didn't just slow it down, they stopped it. Right? And so when we then went back to the numbers and reapplied the actual numbers, we saw that there was about 195 cities that would have qualified as cities. They walked, talked, and behaved like cities, and so we included them. And then I'll come to this fourth point in a little while. Migration is only half the story. If you looked at various numbers, you know, there was a lot of hype about the amount of migration that took place and so on, so we decided to investigate this. And we found that migration was only one part of the story, and the remaining urban expansion in population came from other arenas as well. This is a very quick look at the way we defined urbanization. So when we imposed the definition, we used the international standard of, and the best way to describe this coming close is Manhattan plus the relevant suburban areas, right, that made up a city. And we imposed this on all the 858 cities that we considered. Now, on migration, so what actually took place? From 1990 to 2005, our estimate was that there was about 103 million people who migrated. What you saw in various other literature would put this number between 140 as high as 350 million, because the number of these estimates came from a top-down perspective. And what we did was we basically went down, right, to the city level, define exactly what a migrant was, which is basically anyone who leaves a particular area and goes to another area and lives for longer than 6 months, right? And that was the definition that we used, and we came up with 103. The significant part of the urban expansion that took place between 1999 and 2005 was actually coming from land expansion, not migration. right? So that explains the difference between what you see in other places. So what cities were actually doing is they were expanding horizontally, and as they expanded, they accumulated the population, right? Now that's not exactly migration. It's basically in situ expansion. Now, if you think that migration was the big story in the past 15 years, you ain't seen nothing yet, right? Because over the next 20 years through 2025, our estimate is that migration is going to be even much higher at about 243 million. And over the next 20 years, you're actually going to see less of that land expansion taking place because they're basically running out of land, right? Cities can't keep on expanding horizontally, and also the government has clamped down on the expansion of land because of the depletion of arable land, which China does not have too much of. Going forward, China is moving towards an urban billion. We believe that by 2025, there will be about 926 million people. And this chart breaks up the population categories into size, from mega, which is 10 million in population and above, down to big towns, which is less than 0.5 of a million. Now, the interesting thing down here is that the expectation is that the largest or the quickest and growth rate is going to really take place from the megacity component and the mid-sized cities. These are the areas that that are likely to grow fastest. If you look at it from a city dimension, how many cities all this amounts to, from 2005, 858 cities, we are expecting to see by 2025, 939 cities. Right now, China has got two megacities, Beijing and Shanghai. We expect that by 2025, there'll be eight of them. And you see the list of those eight in rank order on the right side of the chart. Mid-sized cities, just to give you an idea of what's going on in China, is between 1.5 million and 5 million population in the mid-sized cities. There are about 69, about 70 in 2005. This is expected to be 115. If you've gone to Singapore or you've gone to Taipei or Seoul, this is basically 115 Singapores, right? 115 Taipeis. So in terms of the context of the size, it's just a huge number of cities. What this also, when you take a picture of this when you visualize this, this also shows that China has. Will on trend, right, on historical basis, is likely to head to a very dispersed model of urbanization. And it's got significant implications with regards to issues like energy use, water use, pollution, and so on. And I'll come to that. This is an interesting chart here. Very often we look at China's progression, right, in terms of the individual cities. What we found is that there are about 11 clusters of cities, each amounting to about between 40 million and 60 million in total population. Right? Now, so when you look at these clusters, it presents a very different picture of China. These total 11 clusters basically account for about 52% of Chinese GDP. Right? And from a private sector perspective, looking at these clusters, you're literally looking at almost self-contained countries, right? Spread across China. So when you're looking at Shanghai, it's not just Shanghai, which is of interest. Shanghai has got about 17 million. In population, but it's got 58 other cities surrounding Shanghai, and it presents completely different perspectives in terms of how you approach China, at least from a commercial business perspective. Scenarios. We looked at four different scenarios, and the top two are concentrated scenarios, which we've termed as super cities and hubs and spoke. And the two additional scenarios that we painted was one of distributed growth and townization. Super cities would see an emergence of about four very large-scale cities, between 30 to 40 million even. A good example of a super city is Tokyo, right, and Osaka as well. And we looked at these super cities as one extreme, right, of scenarios. And then the other concentrated scenario that we looked at was hubs and spokes, right? And as the name suggests, basically a city that is surrounded by smaller spoke cities, smaller or mid-sized spoke cities. And a good example of an existing hub and spoke system is Seoul, surrounded by several other cities. And this is where we saw that, you know, there are about 11 economic clusters, each between 30 to 90 million evolving in each of these hubs and spokes. And then we looked on the other extreme at distributed growth. And interestingly, the U.S. is a good model of a distributed growth system, right, where you've got a fairly large number of mid-sized cities between 1.5 million and 5 million emerging over time. And then finally, we looked at a very extreme and probably implausible scenario, which is townization, lack of a better term. And this is where this actually represented one view, right, of the Chinese political leadership, right, that they could in fact head towards a townization model where you had well over 1,000 cities scattered toward China. And so we thought that it would be interesting to look at it. Now, why would the political leadership actually consider townization as a potential model? They never told us the reason why, but at least reading in between the lines, one of the plausible explanations is that they feel that it's in fact politically a lot easier to control 1,000 over cities than it is to control 15 Shanghai. And that was one of the takeaways that we got in the discussions that we had with a number of government officials. What do these super cities mean? And it's worthwhile just looking at this chart very quickly. When we looked at super cities, it doesn't mean that all of China goes towards super cities, right? What we do mean is that there will be a preponderant of the population headed towards the super cities, and so if it is a super city scenario, you would have a population of 374 million in the mega cities, and if it was a townization scenario, you would still have super cities and big cities and so on, but the preponderance of the population would be in the smaller areas. When we did these scenarios, we looked at several pressure points, right, that each of these scenarios could face up to. And these are some of the pressures that we looked at. What would be the implications on land development, congestion, jobs and skills, thank you, funding, water, energy, and pollution. Now, this is like a traffic light, right? So the red colors mean very high pressure, and the green colors mean low pressures. When you take a quick glance at this chart, what it tells you is that, or at least our findings indicate that the concentrated scenarios, super cities and hubs and spokes, have relatively less pressure or will face less pressure, right, from these variables compared to the dispersed scenarios. It doesn't mean that there would be no issues with the super cities and the concentrated scenarios like super cities and hub and spoke. Let me go through this very quickly. Land development. In our analysis, we find that the super cities and hubs and spokes would actually face up with less pressure in land development. The as you know, as many of you may know, in China, arable land is at a critical level, right? Because of the rapid expansion of cities, arable land had been indiscriminately depleted over the past 15 to 20 years. Under the concentrated scenario, the arable land, or the rate of loss of arable land, would be limited to about 7%. Right? If China opted to go towards the dispersed scenarios, there could be up to 20% of arable land loss. Right? On congestion, it's a different story. Right? Super cities would likely see a greater deal of congestion taking place. In fact, in our estimates in Shanghai, for example, although Shanghai has got very good policies in place to control traffic congestion and so on, if it doesn't expedite these policies over the next 6 or 7 years, Shanghai is going to turn into a parking lot. Right? And jobs and skills, again, right? The super cities super cities and hubs and spoke would be better able to attract talent than the smaller cities is one of our findings. In funding, the concentrated scenarios would actually yield GDPs, right, which are about 20% in excess, right, of the dispersed scenarios, and so that helps in the funding process. In water demand, it's the exact reverse, right? The dispersed scenarios, right, would see water demand that is more tolerable than super cities. However, super cities would be better able to manage, right, these water demand. Now, going down to the last row on pollution, you'll see that it's all red right across. Basically, whatever scenario China takes, it's likely to face significant issues in pollution. For super cities, they're going to have to deal with peak pollution problems like nitrous oxide. In the dispersed scenarios, they're probably going to be seeing excessive water pollution, right? So it's just the difference in the type of pollution, but pollution is going to be an issue no matter what scenario China adopts. So in this particular, from this analysis that we did, we felt confident enough, right, that, look, overall, the direction that China ought to be taking, right, is towards the concentrated model of growth. Right? Now, we actually stuck our necks out, but we are actually glad that we did this because it has opened up a debate, right, on this, and a debate that is founded on a fact base, right, of what the implications of these different scenarios might be. There are several requirements as well, right, for each of the scenarios. And we looked at infrastructure, intercity transportation, freight, residential construction, all the typical variables that you would look at in urbanization. I'm just going to present two of them to you. Mass transit requirements, and what is the build requirements, right, for construction. In the different scenarios that we looked at, from distributed growth to townization, you're going to see a large-scale requirements of just light rail systems and subway systems that come into play. Using the criteria that the Chinese government use under the distributed growth model, right, where you have several mid-sized cities scattered throughout China, you could see up to 171 of these systems, mostly light rail systems. If you look at super cities, it's about 102. Now, the question that would come up to your mind is, well, does, you know, super cities having only 102 systems, why would that be, you know, so significantly smaller than the distributed growth scenarios? Well, what happens is that under the super city scenario, you basically have much larger scale systems, right? And in fact, under super cities, you could see an additional requirement of 150,000 to 400,000 rail cars, right, needed. But the story down here is basically that it is massive, right? And in order to keep China running, right, with the rate of urbanization that it's undergoing over the next 20 years, is just a tremendous amount of infrastructure that is required. Building, China will require a Chicago every year. Right, this is about 1,000 skyscrapers. And the definition of a skyscraper here is anything above 30 stories. Right? And this is under the trend line or distributed growth or townization scenario. Right. So in other words, if China progresses at the historical pace that it has been, it would add, you know, a Chicago each year. But under if it did progress towards the super cities or the hubs and spokes scenarios, you could well see, you know, in excess of 3,000 to 4,000 buildings, or 3 to 4 Chicagos each year. Again, the story is that it's very large. Our belief in this message is that China is probably well advised, right, to head towards the concentrated scenarios, and big is potentially best, right, in the case of China. There's another critical message that that our study has revealed, and that is this notion of urban productivity. We looked at, you know, as we scanned Chinese cities, what we saw was that there were opportunities, no matter what scenario China took, in changing the fundamental mindset, right, of how China develops. Over the past 15 to 20 years, the major focus in Chinese development has been enhanced GDP growth. Right? GDP at all expense. Mayors, city leaders were basically incentivized to deliver on GDP. Right? What we believe is that we are now at a stage where China could take a slight turn, right, where instead of putting the focus on GDP, you could put the focus on the quality of the inputs that you use to drive GDP, right? And thus the concept of urban productivity. Right? How would you enhance the quality of the inputs to GDP, whether it's water use, energy use, labor, so that ultimately you would still get the GDP, but it's probably going to be a GDP of a higher quality, right, if you will. We believe that there are four strategies, right, for China to look at, and this is something that we've been discussing with a number of the city governments in terms of how it could enhance urban productivity. One is that it could plan for integrated dense development, and what we mean by that is employ, you know, strategic land development plans, integrated mixed-use areas, car traffic demand management, and so on. And I'll give you one example, right, of what China could employ very quickly and make huge gains, right, in terms of attaining greater productivities. Number two is that, you know, over the past 20 years, what we've seen China do very well is that whenever they needed anything, they went and built, right? So it was an investment-led economy. We believe that there's an opportunity now to manage the demand side, right? So in terms of how Chinese citizens use the resources, right, rather than just building additional infrastructure as it did over the past 20 years. And this could, you know, some examples would be energy and water efficient, industrial equipment usage, enhancing the, you know, the insulation standards, right, within buildings, etc. And if, in fact, if you walked into the typical Chinese building, you'd see that there's an enormous number, or rather enormous amount of energy wastage, right, that takes place just purely because of poor insulation standards, poor standards in construction, and so on and so forth. Number three, there's a potential to increase public sector productivity. Whether it's through productivity-based performance systems, like when you look at countries like Singapore, Korea, Taiwan, when they went through this inflection point, right, of growth, they employed a significant amount of thinking in order to redirect the entire country into a new direction where they enhanced performance-based systems. Finally, investing in skills and jobs development. This China faces actually a significant issue in talent. It's not the quantity of talent, right? There's enough of the tertiary institutions that provides the graduates on a yearly basis. But the problem is in terms of the quality of the talent that China has. And we found significant issues in terms of, you know, basic talent requirements like team building, taking responsibility, right, which is in many ways is an alien mode of operations in China. So investing in the skills and job development programs in China is another opportunity for them to enhance productivity. Just one example, right, that I'll give you in terms of the enhancement of of productivity through the strategic use of floor area ratios. If you flew over Manhattan, what would you see? Right? You'd see two nodes of development with the denser buildings occupying the central part of Manhattan, and then you have the shorter buildings develop outside of the central areas. When we looked at Chinese cities, right, and we did the calculations, what we saw was there was a certain randomness, right, about the way buildings sprouted in China. You go to a typical city, and you might find, you know, a 30-story building in the periphery of that city just jut out, right? And there was no pattern, right, to the heights, right, of buildings in many cities. Even in Shanghai, right, one of the most developed cities in China, you'd find the same thing. Now, why is this important? Well, if you strategically planned the city, right, alongside floor area ratios that had higher, the more dense part connected to where your transportation nodes are, right, there's a significant amount of energy savings, right, that you could have. And in China, there is a potential to move in that direction in a very easy way just by changing the regulations, right? Changing the regulations and requiring the enforcement, right, and imposing the enforcement to make sure that height restrictions are maintained and denser development is required. If China adopted a number of these low-hanging fruit policies, what we found is that it could be saving by 2025 about 1.5 trillion renminbi, right, in additional funds. This amount, right, on a cumulative basis to between 10 trillion and 15 trillion renminbi, which is the equivalent to the entire GDP of China today. Right. So there's a tremendous amount of low-hanging fruits that China could embark on, no matter what scenario it took. And this does not even include, right, the gains that it can make from reduced air and water pollution, less loss of arable land, etc., that would be associated, right, with urbanization, especially if it went towards the concentrated urban scenarios. I'm going to stop right here. If you want to get the full download of the report, you could go to this website. And in addition, there is a very interesting interactive, right, that we have on the site that enables you to actually look at the different scenarios and actually see how it evolves, right, from a timeline perspective from now till 2025.
I'd like to just start by emphasizing that I, in spite of having lived in China for a number of years and just finished a book about Chinese urbanization, which came out just last month, I'm not primarily a China specialist. Instead, I come to this subject, which is truly an extraordinary subject, as Jana Mitra has certainly illustrated. I come to it as an urbanist primarily, as an urban planner, and also as an American. And I, as you know, again, Jana Mitra has really laid this out beautifully, the scale and the speed of urban development in China is truly unprecedented. I mean, this is a revolution. This is unlike anything the world has ever seen. We all here could list the statistics all afternoon to hammer this home, and the statistics are just extraordinary. I'll spare you some of those. I think we have a good idea about that by now. So this is clearly a revolution, but it's also much of what China is going through. We've seen in some form here. Before in the West, and especially in the United States, even if on a much, much smaller scale. And this is, in fact, one of the themes that runs through my book, this kind of bewitching consonance between the American urban experience and what China is going through in a much more spectacular way today, and it has been since the 1980s. The only great exception, or one of the greatest exceptions, I should say, is that China has gone through this in a super compressed period of time, basically has experienced the transformations of cities that we've undergone in a 150-year period in less than a generation, right? I was in Shanghai last summer I had taken a group of 15 of my undergraduate students on a month-long course across China. I actually survived that. I was in Shanghai one night walking along the promenade along the river there, looking out to the towers across the river at Pudong. And this, you all know, well, let me put an image of that. So in case you don't know what that looks like, this is a photo I took actually that night. What I came to realize that this scene, looking at this, was prompting the same set of emotions, the same odd mix of emotions in myself, and of both fascination but also fear, of both admiration but also a certain awe and trepidation, perhaps. The same mix of emotions that touring Europeans a century ago conveyed in their diaries and letters home of the American city, of Chicago rising on the plains in the 1880s, rebuilding itself after the Great Fire, or of Lower Manhattan, you know, lifting above the New York Harbor there. Very similar set of, and what I'm getting at here is that when it comes to when it came to building cities, the old world looked to us much the way that we now look to look across the Pacific to China. In a way, the muse of urban futurism has kind of moved across the Pacific, and if that's the case, if this muse of visionary urbanism has left our shores, and I believe it has. I mean, we've really become a largely suburban nation in the last two generations or so now. One that, in my opinion, has really lost the capacity we once had to imagine a grand urban future, right? To make, as Daniel Burnham, the great Chicago architect, once put it, to make no little plans, right? And so let's assume that. Let's say the muse of urban futures has now roosted among these great buildings here, somewhere in Shanghai or maybe in Shenzhen. What I think we must hope for now is that, and work for, is that the demon of bad planning doesn't follow on her wings. And by bad urban planning, what I mean is all that, you know, we Americans kind of went whole hog for after Detroit gave us affordable cars and gas was cheap, and the Leavitt brothers showed us how to carpet the landscape with single-family homes and suburbia, basically, and suburbanization and sprawl, inefficient and unsustainable, as we all know and are learning again as gasoline crawls toward $5 a gallon, laced with highways and big box power centers and shopping malls and so forth. I say all this because China is on the verge of taking this route, taking this path, as the report, I think, makes quite clear, and as all the evidence shows. China is doing a lot of things right when it comes to urbanization. It's building great new cities, as we've seen. It's housing lots and lots of people very efficiently in a relatively small land area. It's installed and built more miles of public transit systems than all other nations combined, frankly, in recent years. But Chinese cities are also sprawling across the landscape at a prodigious rate, churning up arable land, precious farmland and open space into vast and relatively, and you have to consider this in the China, relative to China, relatively low-density suburban housing estates and gated communities, some of which, frankly, look like they were airlifted right out of suburban Atlanta or Southern California. But even the denser suburban, actually, you know, if you take that and put it in the American circumstance, it would look like some of our densest cities. But in vis-a-vis China, this kind of advertisement shows here, this in the United States, this would actually be a very dense suburb. But in China, given the numbers and given the small amount of arable of developable land, this is not dense enough. If you compare Landsat images, this is of Chongqing. If you compare Landsat images of Chinese cities from the 1980s to today, really the change resembles some kind of interstellar explosion, like a supernova or something. It's really extraordinary. The Chinese have a more grounded. This is between roughly 90 and today, Chongqing. And you know that's to me is a supernova. The Chinese have a more grounded term for this. Some of you may know it as tandabing, which means to make to bake a pancake or a big pancake. So this pancaking across the landscape, whatever you call it, it's a colossal problem and a looming problem. Unconcentrated, sprawlish development has already consumed an enormous amount of land. The statistic I came up with, and you may have come up with a different one, was something like 44,000 square miles of arable land has been developed upon. That's roughly, to give you an idea, is roughly the area of all of New England. And of course, it's due to losses like this that China is rapidly confronting a major food production problem, and is now, you probably heard this in the news, is actively looking in South America and Africa and even Cuba for land to lease for food production. Much of this suburban development is unapologetically oriented toward motorists. This is actually the first drive-through fast food restaurant that opened in Nanjing two summers ago in 2006. And this is one of the reasons why China has become the fastest-growing automobile market in the world. Right, second in size now only to the United States. Cars are all the rage among the Chinese middle class. The largest showrooms on earth are not in Houston or L.A., but in China, like this one here. This is from a brochure I was given by the folks at this place called the Hangzhou Automobile City. 32-acre showroom floor, 24 American football fields. I challenge anyone to show me an auto showroom that big in the United States. And by 2022 or so, the Chinese national highway system is actually going to exceed the total mileage of the American interstates, and at that moment we'll take the title for the largest human construction on the face of the earth. And already, the Chinese have built about 30,000 miles of modern highway, and that, remember, that's starting from almost zero in 1978 or so, right? So what I'll close by just underlining very vigorously and many times, imagine me with a highlighter, really I think one of the chief conclusions of the report, and that's concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. It's focused development as tightly as possible on the land, and avoid at all costs the manifold inefficiencies and unsustainabilities of wholesale sprawl. We all know the story here in the West. We're running out of oil. We're running out of food and places to grow food. We're warming the atmosphere at an alarming rate. And the very last thing I think this beleaguered planet needs is another several hundred million more motorists driving everywhere for everything. Right? Those of you who have grown up in suburbia know that you need to get in the car to do everything. And another society that follows our mistakes, basically, and smothers the Earth's surface with more inefficient settlement patterns. Thank you.
Jennifer, how much time do you have?
I'm fine.
You're fine. Deanna, you said to leave at 3:30. Okay. Would you like to open up for questions now, or did you have something? Okay. I don't know. Jeremy, I know you have to leave soon. Do you have a question you want to fire off?
Yeah, I just first thank the speakers for absolutely terrific, thought-provoking presentations. And I guess the question, I was scribbling here. I had something about autos, actually, which you touched on, I think. In the question that comes to my mind is in terms of the government function, the function of government, the role of government in creating the type of urbanization that you've outlined, the need for more concentration. We here are constantly, I think, at all levels of government, are urging the Chinese to look more toward the market and away from industrial planning type of functions. And I would just be interested in both of your views on what the implications are in terms of the type of government that we're likely to see from China over the next 20 years in terms of industrial planning functions and in particular urban planning functions. And be interested in your thoughts on that.
I know that one of the main causes, and I think you both are familiar with this, one of the main causes of this wholesale sprawl is the way that the local governments are able to convert land in the outlying district. Well, one thing that's critical to understand the difference between American cities and Chinese cities is, and John Amitri, you touched on this, The administrative footprint of Chinese cities is enormous compared to American cities. Like, you know, there's miles and miles of farmland that is actually in Beijing, in the city of Beijing, because the administrative limits of the city are so huge. And so what happens is that these farm areas, these agricultural areas, are actually just outlying districts of the city. And what the government can do, the local officials can convert that land use category. Land conversion, convert it from rural use to urban use, and thereby lease the development rights, and make, you know, there's enormous windfalls for the government in this. So the suburbanization, the sprawling, is
is happening for very different reasons that you know went on here in the United States. As you all know, here in the United States, the suburbs were separate entities from the cities in most cases, right? So when we had the enormous like white flight of the 1960s and 70s, the cities lost, or the suburbs gained was the cities lost because the tax base moved from the city to these independent towns and suburban communities. So it's a very different kind of process, and I think that therein at least there are some obvious policy solutions that could fix that part of the problem at least quite effectively.
I think one of the we don't believe that China ought to step away from the market forces, and I think they are committed as well, right, to market-oriented changes. I think, and in fact, one of the findings, right, of our study is that urbanization in China has largely been a local phenomenon. It is not, as I think a number of us in the West have come to believe, that that Beijing has got a few buttons that it can press, and lo and behold, you get a certain type of urbanization taking place. No. And in fact, over the past 15 years, urbanization has been, very decentralized. I think what China does have is an opportunity now to enact greater, or enact policies that are enforceable. One, the enforceability element is a significant issue in China, whether it's in land policy or energy regulation and so on and so forth. And these policy dimensions, the national government can in fact adopt to try to spur China towards a particular direction, right? And there are already experiments in this. The question is, can China actually move, can the national government actually help China to move towards a concentrated growth scenario? And the answer to that is yes, right, with certain types of policies. For example, the experiment of Chongqing. Chongqing was actually given special municipality status, right, that moved it, allowed it flexibility to develop its urbanization at its own pace. Right? There are specific, policies that China could do to enforce denser development, right? By making it, in fact, a lot more difficult, right, for the smaller and mid-sized cities, right, from growing horizontally. And by the way, if you look at the policy manual, right, that Beijing has, a lot of the policies are already in place. And if you have an argument with the national with the policy wonks in Beijing, they say, well, we have all of these, right? We've got this dense population, urbanization ratio. We even have the floor area ratios to regulate heights and so on. The problem is that all that is on paper, and almost nothing is taking place in terms of enforcement. Right? So that's a significant issue.
Hi. I just have a quick question about the rural-urban divide and that problem. Now, your policy proposal advocates the concentrated supercenters scenario. And I'm just wondering what you have to say about how that will impact the rural-urban divide, which, if it will exacerbate that perhaps, because those supercenters will inevitably probably exist in the coastal areas first, as they have. We've seen. And And of course, such an exacerbation of the divide will have detrimental effects on development, social issues, on democratization in China. I just want to know what you have to say about that.
I'll start with your last point, which is on democratization, because if you ask any young Chinese citizen, they would insist that they already have a good working democratization process. I think the rural-urban divide is going to happen anyway, right? The fact is that the migration patterns are already on a path, right, headed in the direction in which there's going to be an accelerated pace of rural to urban migration. Now, there is a positive side, right, to this rural to urban migration, I believe that initially you're going to have an exacerbation of income inequality, right, as migration begins to take place. But productivity, right, in the rural areas is in fact lagging that of the urban centers. There have been several calculations that have been done that there's in fact too many people, right, in the in rural area of China, something like 400 million. Right? So, in other words, the movement, right, of rural migrants to urban areas is actually going to enhance the productivity, right, of the agricultural sector, right, by these people actually moving into the urban areas, and that has in fact been taking place over the past 15 years. So while I think the bigger challenge, right, is with all these migrants, or rural migrants moving into urban areas, the challenge of providing for education, healthcare, pension systems, retirement, you know, systems for the migrants are not in place. And so what's been happening, and the Chinese government is very well aware of it, is that social tensions, right, have increased in the urban areas. Because the income inequality that is interesting to watch is not between the urban-rural divide, right, but it's more so in within the urban areas, between the migrant populations and the urban population. Our estimates, right, on the potential on the future migration, if you do a very quick back of the envelope calculation, you'll see that China in 20 years. Is going to have they're going to have cities which have roughly 40% on average, right, of their population being migrants, which means an enormous challenge, right, in terms of providing for healthcare, education, retirement. These are the three big things that China is going to have to face up to, and it does not have as a nation, it does not have a coherent policy to take care of its migrant population.
Hi, Stephen Cloud from the Homeland Security Program.
I'd like to follow on the same track as the previous question, but focus on the agricultural potential of China with the large-scale urbanization that you've been mentioning, particularly your point about the officials being able to take farmland, which are part of the larger cities.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Oh, well, how would this impact the agricultural potential of China with the large-scale urbanizations going on? Yeah.
Well, I think if development is concentrated in a number of super cities or the hub and spoke scenario you talked about, it will protect vast areas of land from that low density kind of sprawl that is the real problem. So, you know, it's implicit in that there's going to be protections or a greater amount of farmland undeveloped.
Yeah, one of the essential things about agriculture, the agricultural story here, which is not just a China story, but it's particularly a China story, is that most of what will and won't happen to agricultural sufficiency has to do with what kind of yield gains you'll see, what kind of productivity you'll see. And, you know, not only is China still largely rural, that's about to change, but all the farming there is subsistence farming. It's very subscale. It's very inefficient. And so in some senses, you've got two things competing. Janamitra talked about arable land coming offline as these cities expand and take over that land use. But at the same time, you have huge potential for productivity gains, yield crop gains. And just how those bear out, you know, hard to tell. But this isn't only a story of urbanization and land use. I would argue the bigger story on agriculture is going to be what, to what degree is that kind of, you know, extraordinary revolution in productivity that we've seen elsewhere, particularly in the U.S. and other countries that have not regulated their agriculture quite so much, play out there.
Just want to add, I mean, it's indirectly related to your question, but we were very curious when we embarked on this study on figuring out whether China had slums. And if you read the books, right, and the policy statements and so on, and the Chinese government would boast about, you know, its development being essentially slum-free, right? And we wanted to see whether that was real. Now, obviously, there's no way, you know, that you can do it empirically. But our MGI team, right, went off, you know, in those several cities. I literally told my colleagues to say, look, go find me a slum, right? Go to those cities and go find, you know, some slum, because I don't believe this, right, that China doesn't have the slums. I mean, after all, in the urbanization of India, in the Philippines, in Brazil, saw just immense slums, right? Now, I'm sure there are slums, but we could not find them, right? We could not find them in the cities that we looked at. Now, one of the explanations, as we began, you know, trying to understand this phenomenon, it was an amazing story, right, of urbanization, and which has sort of kept the slums down to a very low level. And it's unique to China. It's because of China's land structure or land policy structure that enables cities, right, to basically buy the peripheral areas at very low prices, right, and then resell it in the commercial market for much higher prices. And that situation or that ability to transact on land enabled a number of Chinese cities to basically fund urbanization. So in other words, building or urbanization took place even before the people came in, right, to the cities. Right? Now that's one of the explanations. So in the case of India, right, or Brazil, urbanization took place down there through tax measures, or the funding of urbanization was through tax dollars. Right? So migrants came in, they were taxed, and then used the tax dollars in order to fund urbanization. In China, it was exactly the opposite. There were some cities that we looked at which had up to 60% of their funding of urbanization, right, come from land transactions. So there's a positive side of the story, and I don't mean to downplay the fact that, you know, there were also losers, right, in this particular episode, because I mean what took place was that farmers, right, were often ill compensated, right, for the land that they effectively sold to the cities.
They were compensated generally, as I understand it, based on the actual crop yield of the land, not the final value of the land that's developed.
Yeah.
And enormous tensions therein.
Bill? I'm Bill Better with Caterpillar, and I recently just returned to the U.S. from having managed criminal affairs for CAD in China for quite a number of years. So I can't not think in terms of the role of the government in these sorts of discussions. I mean, I think this is absolutely fascinating, and the two issues that immediately popped into my mind have been touched on just a bit, but I wanted to perhaps draw them out a little more. The first, Dr. Devon, I think, was your comment that there is, you know, real question how much the central government really can control a lot of the development that's taking place. And I think, in my experience, that's the single biggest misunderstanding people seem to have in the West. There's this impression of a central government where somebody snaps a finger, presses a button, and then everything happens. And nothing could be further from the truth in China. So I wonder to what extent, even if the central government were able to come up with a model that it felt was most beneficial to China, it could really do anything about it. I was listening to the comments. I attended a conference, as I have for several years, called the China Development Forum, which takes place each year following the National People's Congress. And I can't remember the subject of urban development being brought up once in the last session in March. It was a three-day conference at Douyutai, and I can't remember any of these issues being brought up. So it's not just a question to me of can the central government really, really control the process, but are they even trying to? And the second issue was if there is a strategy or a number of people looking into to managing how the cities do continue to develop, there are bound to be some political issues that are going to come into play. There are going to be questions that come into play along the lines of what model is going to be more conducive for promoting social harmony, with social harmony defined as not rocking the political boat. Or there would be questions on which model will be most likely to either encourage or discourage reliance on foreign investment. A number of these political questions would come into play totally independent of what is the best model for the greatest number of people. So I guess the question gets back a little bit to the extent that the central government really is focused on trying to control this. And secondly, are there other issues that are being brought into play that maybe haven't been touched on, such as political issues on what will be the best approach to maintaining a quote-unquote harmonious society?
I think, at various levels, the government has, in fact, been, pressing the buttons, right, of urbanization, but in a very subdued way. The model that I actually see happening is not, a grandiose plan, right, on urbanization, but a prototyping model, right, that the Chinese government seems to have enacted on different fronts. One is, Chongqing is an example where, it's an overt political play to give more power, right, to cities, and we believe that they would take these lessons and then spread it out to other cities. I don't think it's going to be imposed at a national level. There are other examples. There are some great examples of solving problems in water demand, especially in the northern parts of China. Tianjin, right, is a classic example where they have they've allowed the national government has collaborated with Tianjin to embark on water management programs that they've never tried anywhere else, right? With the idea that if it does work in Tianjin, then the learning is going to take place at the city level, right? And the interesting thing is that in fact, a lot of that takes place, a lot of that has taken place between 1990 and 2005 even, right, where there is city collaboration, because we've seen, examples of success, right, in one city actually translate very quickly to any number of other cities. Another example is Wuhan's, right, enactment of changing the incentive systems, right, for local government officials, and the national government knows that it's a huge problem on incentives. And in fact, when they tried to do it at the national level, it failed. Right? There was a wholesale rebellion almost, right, among city mayors to say no, we're not going to go with this green incentive system in place of GDP and so on. But then where it does work, right, is where they've given, they've worked with particular cities, right, to prototype a particular, a new incentive system and then to push that out. And I think they'll find that balance, right? right? I don't believe that there will be, you know, any grandiose plan other than an obvious national policy that you can make on enforcement of energy, energy use, pollution standards, and so on.
If I could steal my rights of moderation here, this moderator, sorry. I wonder if you could comment on the actual migration process and the hukou system. And if, I mean, one of the reasons why you don't have the slums, I think, is because of, even though the hukou system's been relaxed, it's still there.
Yeah.
But it also seems to me that if you continue along the same path where it's still there but it's relaxed, the way it is right now, it leads to some of the problems in the sense that the males can go work in the construction areas. They don't bring their families with them. If they do, their children can't go to school. It's hard for them to open bank accounts, to get loans, to actually establish. So they're somewhat consigned to a second-class citizenry. But if you were to somehow open that up and completely relax it, would you then run the risk of slums and uncontrolled? Because I don't think you can really control where the migrants go. They go where the opportunities are. And so it would seem to me that there's a double-edged sword there. And so what's your sense on what is the government looking at doing and what do you think they should do?
There's been a lot of pressure on the government to ease up on the hukou policy. We don't see them doing it rapidly, right? They do know that it will have to ease up, and in fact, it has been easing since 1990, to 2005. It'll probably take another 10 to 15 years, right, before they completely do away with the hukou system for the very reasons that that you bring up. There are social pressures that would visit them with a vengeance, right? If they opened up too quickly. Again, right? The hukou system is one where different cities are experimenting with different policy tools. Shanghai, for example, has experimented with very new ways of dealing with their migrant population, which is about 30% of the entire population, in selectively being more selective with regards to the type of migrants, right, who are granted hukou status, or granting certain classes of hukou, non-hukou residents, educational permits, health standards, and so on. Beijing is doing it in a completely different way. The smaller cities are embarking on different programs as well. So there are different city experiments, which might lead to specific options for the national government to then say, look, you know, we could adopt this at a national level. They're not there yet.
Thank you for this important topic. Sorry I was late. I don't know where to mention this. I want to clear something. Every city in China has a slum. If you do not think there's one, I'll take you. It's very easy to find. In Beijing, I can name five, okay? Xinjiang Sun, Henan Sun, Hubei Sun. All the kind of migrant villages, they're slums. The urban villages, and in Shanghai, I can name you 10, okay? I'm from Wuhan. Wuhan have 20. I'm very familiar. I studied this. So there are slums, but of course, because it's 90% residents are from migrants, and also they are, number one, the government cracked down very heavily. Number two, the mobility rate is also very high. They move a lot. And number three is that because the development is so fast, that's the one, sometimes, the forced mouth. So the different things. One thing I think is very interesting, the data you show and then the talk you gave. I have been working on the future of Chinese political arrangement. I call it the Chinese federalism with big Chinese federalism. That means in the future, in the political system, probably, the center cannot really dictate everything. So the city, instead of province, will be the major role in terms of, loosely controlled, economically. And urban planning has already de facto, China already achieved de facto economic and urban planning federation. in a way, you know, not political. So I think that if we push that around to see that possibility, but when I talk to Chinese leaders, especially at the top level, they say, oh, no way, there's no way you can do it. But if you talk to the urban government, especially I have this wonderful experience when I was talking to the government in Guangzhou City and Shenzhen City, and they have a big argument in 2001 saying that they want to make Guangdong and Guangzhou, Shenzhen become part of Hong Kong, okay? Because Hong Kong and Taiwan and Macau already achieved, you know, de facto federation. You know, they're part of the federal provinces, whatever region you can call it. So they want to be part of that. And then when I talk to Hunan, the government, they said, okay, if they did that first, if the border starts at the Guangzhou, next is Hunan's. So there are people in the provincial government or the big city government think in that line, but not at the top of the elite. But as the picture you show, that urban city, you know, began to increase their power and their population, and with the internet and whatever, I think the possibility could be there. What do you think? Is that urban-based Chinese political federation? Thank you very much.
No, I think that's very, very insightful. And as I indicated, you know, one of the motivations for us to do this study was when we had questions, or rather views like this, especially from the top leadership, where we at least read in between the lines that, you know, there were folks who were wary, right, of China becoming too concentrated. And I think it is a political issue, right? There are, and you'll find two different types of political leaders, I think, right? Again, one is the new political leadership, right, which have this non-engineering background, more of the economists and the, you know, the legal people and so on, who are thinking more along the lines of a China becoming, you know, a series of super cities, hubs and spokes and so on, and that they see this as being fundamentally good for the country. But there is the old group, right, who I believe are still leaning towards, you know, everything in terms of political economy, right, not economics, right, and that second group are the ones who profess, you know, more of a scattered approach. They would not be the ones who would be supporting a Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Guangdong, you know, getting together, right? Purely because it changes the political power equation. Right? So you're absolutely right. But I do see, at least if trends are anything to go by, that the shift is getting gradually more towards the former, you know, group of people that or leadership that I mentioned, and that is leadership which is open to this idea, right, of concentration of political power, as long as you don't upset the system. So I do see that. And then, by the way, on your slums, I completely agree. There are slums. There must be. But I think the difference is this. Go to a Manila, and you'll see a slum, right, with over, you know, a million people, right? And and you're talking about slums. The technical definition of slums are those people who are completely disenfranchised from the system. Right? In China, there are poor places. So there are several places in Shanghai and Beijing and so on that you would see, you know, places that look like slums. It would not be anywhere the scale that you see in India, right, in the Philippines, in Sao Paulo. Right? And then
that's
a lot of them...
That's a bad thing for China.
Yeah, no.
Before, on the mall, there's no bankers. But because the police will lock people up, the Chinese people lost their right to beg for food. That's not a good thing. That's
absolutely
not a good thing. Because people living in slum, even in developing countries, are not the lowest poorest.
These urban villages are also very unstable because
as places to house these people, because a group of us visited a couple in Shenzhen last year, and you know, one of which is just you know, the local patriarchy there are very wealthy men now, because they don't even work; they just collect all the rent from the migrants. But one of the other villages we visited, they decided that the greater profits would be made if they redeveloped. And so they cleared everything. All the super dense buildings that had been put up years ago to rent to the migrant workers are all gone, and they put these like enormous luxury towers up there.
Yeah.
So it's certainly not something that, you know, it's not a sustainable model for housing, for low-income housing.
I think we have time for maybe one more question. Okay, right here.
I was just wondering, in light of recent natural disasters, this concentrated model, would it be more safe or less safe than a more sprawled out model, in reference to like natural disasters like earthquakes and things like that?
I'll just take a crack at it. I don't know what the answer to that is, but the one positive thing that has happened in the recent earthquakes and so on is that it's put a lot of pressure on them on enhancing the standards that they use for construction and building. There is a lot of shoddy, you know, construction that takes place throughout China. In the big cities, in the smaller cities, and so on. You know, a building is typically meant to last about 100 years, right? In a number of the buildings in Shanghai and Beijing, you find that they literally begin crumbling after 30 years, right? Because the quality of the cement that is used, right? It's sort of ammonia laden, right? In order to enhance the drying process, but it crumbles.
Or it's not allowed to dry in enough. You know, there's this term in Shenzhen, well, you probably know this, it's called Shenzhen speed. It was the speed that buildings were, well, one building in particular, the International Trade Center in Shenzhen in the late 80s was put up, and they actually did three, they were able to do a floor every 3 days. And then the Diwang Tower, the Lanking Tower, beat that record. 2.5 days per floor. Now, when you're pushing it this end, it was because they added some thing to make it supposedly cure fast. That's a very good question, and I think you have the potential for super catastrophes if the building codes are not enforced. They're there. Tangshan earthquake in 1976, you know, was a super disaster. Killed at least 250,000 people, probably double that. And there were all sorts of new regulations put in place about earthquake-proof construction. So that kind of stuff would really have to be enforced if super concentration is going to be safe.
And I think, you know, ultimately it is about enforcement of the regulations. I mean, environmental regulations. There's in the U.S. here, we have, you know, an EPA, and you can say what you like about it, right? But the EPA is an enforcement agency in many regards, and it's got the numbers to back it up. Go to China, in their equivalent, you know, protection agency, just don't have the numbers. They number in the hundreds as opposed to the thousands, right, of people who should be doing the enforcement.
And when you're building, as you said, a Chicago every year, yeah, this, you know, speed kills basically. You just can't keep an eye on and that, you know, there's also an element of corruption which has been coming through in the news reports from why certain schools fell and other government buildings stood right next door and weren't damaged.
Well, please join me in thanking both Tom and Genevieve.